My daddy was a brakeman in Pullman in the strike of 94. He never knew nothing about the union, but he started learning when they hit that door. Well, it gave him a hot foot and he took to the road, organized the central line. He'd set me on his knee and he would say to me, and I see him from time to time, you got to roll, 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 roll with the union. You got to roll, 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 roll out with the wind. Show the folks how to tell the friends from the labor fakers. When you trust in your class, boy, you know that you're bound to win. When the cops bust in to come to break some heads, there was no place for Sadie to hide. She pushed the first one out the window, kicked the next one down the steps. They've been looking high and low for a year or so, but they never caught Sadie yet. She says, roll, 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 roll with the union. She says, roll, 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 roll out with the wind. Show the folks how to tell the friends from the labor fakers. Put your trust in your class, boy, you know that you're bound to win. Sometimes I get so tired of all this rambling. Got my eye on a pretty piece of land down south Monterey. Sometimes I wonder if the prize is worth all the gambling. Then I hear that train whistle blowing. So long, folks, I'll be going. I'm going to roll, 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 roll with the union. Roll, roll, roll out with the wind. I show the folks how to tell the friends from the labor fakers. I put my trust in my class, boy, I know that we're bound to win.
We are going to be putting together for you now an emergency strike watch program. Support Transport Workers Union Local 100. This is a Building Bridges, your community and labor report special. We're going to find out everything that has really been going on behind the scenes with our brothers and our sisters who are fighting for the hearts and minds of the consumers in the city and for a decent labor contract. And I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. And it's very important that we support our brothers and sisters in TWU, not only for them as we should, but also for all the workers in the city, which this sets a precedent for, Mimi.
And we are going to begin our critical analysis with City Council member Charles Barron, who I saw speaking at the rally on behalf of the Transport Workers Union the other night. And I will say that one of the most progressive, meaningful, critical labor leaders in this city is none other than Roger Toussaint. And Charles Barron, we welcome you to this Building Bridges Labor Strike Watch special.
Well, thank you very, very much. I sure appreciate being on, and this is a critical hour.
Charles, from your perspective, why? Why is this so important?
Well, it's very, very important in that we need to begin to expose these quasi-governments called authorities, the Metropolitan Transit Authority, the Port Authority, the Power Authority, the Housing Authority. These were quasi-governments set up by Robert Moses, a racist architect, who was separating New York City and needed to manipulate government funds by setting up these authorities that were basically run by rich white men and had no oversight from the state or the city. This is why the MTA can have a $1 billion surplus, and there were questions in their budget prior and not want to give workers their fair share of wages and benefits and health benefits and decent working conditions. For the MTA to come up a three-year contract with a 3% raise and then have the new workers pay into their health benefits and the old workers not have to do that is a crying shame. And I think the people of this city should not blame. If they must strike, the people of this city should put the blame squarely where it belongs, and that is with the MTA. They have the resources, but they don't have the will to give the workers a decent contract. I wish we were sophisticated enough to tell the TWU, you don't have to strike. The people should strike.
Oh, for sure.
The people should say, we're not going to ride until you give our workers a decent contract. And you can't use the Taylor law against us or any kind of injunction. And Mayor Bloomberg, once again, he's trying to use intimidation, which will not work with Roger Tucson. The last time he told him to shut up, and this time he ripped up his injunction, court injunction. So I think we have some strong, progressive leadership from Roger Tucson, and the people of New York City should support their workers.
And Charles, you're on the city council. Are you on the vanguard of the city council on this, or are there other people in the city council who are saying what you're saying, that the MTA is wrong in this regard and that the TWU should fight for the membership?
Well, I think they got most of the support from the members of the city council, particularly the Black, Latino, and Asian caucus. It's 25 of us out of the 51. I know we're very supportive. John Liu has been very supportive. Robert Jackson, Bill Perkins, all of us are very, very supportive of the TWU. So they have great support in the city council.
You know, you mentioned something I hadn't really thought of, and it took me back to 1966. And we'll talk more about that during the course of the program, when the fiery founder of the Transport Workers Union, Michael Quill, called a strike, and it was the first day of the administration of John V. Lindsay. And I watched the consumers out there, and I joined in, and there was a sense of pride, and there was a sense of the dignity of the working class striking out, no puns intended, for the benefit of those who create the wealth of this society. And Charles, I can't think of anybody better to begin this program with than someone like yourself who really understands who creates the wealth, who moves this city. It is the workers. And in terms of this particular union, we have 34,000 workers, a good majority of whom are people of color. What do you think that means in this context as well?
Well, it means that, you know, continually other unions that aren't as dominated by people of color usually get better contracts. And then the TWU is always given a difficult time by the mayors of this city. And it shows once again that, one, we are the most oppressed, but secondly, it also shows our power. If, in fact, we had a day of absence just to display that we could shut this city down if we didn't get our fair share of contracts, whether it's benefits and pension and wages and proper working conditions. So what are they asking for? They want two people in the train. They want a motorman and a conductor. They want token booths to be have human beings in token booths and not close down the token booths and go to some computerized system with the trains and some metro card machines. I mean, they're asking for decent things for the safety of our people. The first line of defense and of crime and health and health emergency is the token booth clerk and oftentimes the train conductor. So these people, our people have been working for indecent wages and horrible conditions for a very long time. And it's time for the new majority to rise up. 65% of the city is people of color. 50% of the city council is people of color. And it's time for us to rise up and take a mighty stance with our union and our workers.
Charles, in addition to what I term token wage increases, the MTA is also saying that the next generation, the people who are not yet hired, should work for less. This has been something that Mayor Bloomberg has taken into all of the city contracts, and now it is something that the MTA is continuing. What is your position on that, and what do you think about the precedent this would set for further negotiations, not only with the city, but all throughout the city?
I think it would set a horrible precedent, and then the unions need to unite. Instead of one trying to go in and get a better deal than everybody else, we need to have a united front with the union, and they should have a collective bargaining session where they all decide that we're all going to get 5%, 6%, 8%, 10%, whatever wage increase is, and we're all going to insist that the new hirees get this and that. Instead of letting the mayor manipulate a few, let DC-37 go first, let the TWU go last, and manipulate this thing so that he has set a precedent of what unions would give into. So I think Roger Toussaint is up against the wall, but he's making a strong stance. And I think he'll stand very strong, and if he has to go out and strike, this city should understand that he did it for the sake of the workers and for the people of this city, so they can ride in safety, so they can ride with the high caliber of expertise that we have working in the Transit Workers Union, so that workers can be pleased with their jobs and have their health taken care of while they're doing their jobs. And I think we just all have to band together and support it 100%.
What a wonderful idea. The consumers saying, you know, brothers and sister workers, we are workers. We are with you. We are going to, yes, have that day of absence. We are going to begin the process of a general strike. We going to stay out we are getting cut to ribbons on every front. It's not just the responsibility of the Transport Workers Union. But, Charles, I'm going to take advantage of you just for a moment and deviate a little bit, because one of the big issues also coming up in the council is the question of the speaker. And I know you've been having meetings on that, and I was going to ask you just to give a little bit of a preview and a sense of concern about this very critical position and what it, too, means for progressive people, what it means in context of a city that is now majority, again, people of color.
Well, that's a very timely question, because even the question on contracts with unions, the speaker will have a lot to do with that because of our negotiations with the mayor over the budget. People don't realize that the second most powerful position in this city is the speaker of the city council. While we pay a lot of attention to the mayor, we pay no attention to the speaker. It is the speaker that sits down primarily and negotiates this $50 billion budget, $50 billion. New York City's budget is larger than every African nation's budget, larger than every Caribbean nation's budget, larger than 48 state budgets in the United States. And yet, we allow the speaker's race to go by without making sure we have the right person there. The speaker has a $50 million city council budget. The speaker determines how much our member items, capital money that comes to all of our communities. The speaker determines who is the chair of committees and what committee assignments you get in the city council. And the speaker will also determine whether your legislation lives or dies. So we've been working hard, and my position is that whoever the speaker is, they need to have a more equitable distribution of the wealth in the city council to communities of color and our capital and expense projects. They need to have a more diversified power structure. White men have too much power in the state, in the city, not enough people of color, and not enough women in powerful positions. And we need to have a more democratic process in the city council and take some of the power away from the speaker and empower the members. I initially started off with Leroy Comrie. Unfortunately and disappointingly, he hasn't had the wherewithal to have a campaign that was really, really taken off. And it's 25 of us in the city council, people of color, and we have yet to come up with a person of color to be speaker. So I tried very, very hard to make that happen with Leroy, and it has not happened, or hasn't happened with Joel. I don't think their candidacies are as serious as I would like them to be. So I'm going to support Bill de Blasio, and we are building a coalition around Bill de Blasio, and we want to make sure that progressive people, our issues are on the front burner. He has agreed to that community of color will have more power positions. He has agreed to that. that we will have more resources coming to communities of color. He has agreed to that. So we've built a strong coalition around Bill de Blasio. He's been progressive on affordable housing and all of our issues on race questions. He's been progressive. So we're hoping that we can build this coalition and he be the new speaker.
And we're hoping that you're going to be the next borough president of Brooklyn, but we'll talk about that another time. Charles Barron, we'll see you in that pillared, columned, big White House. Maybe
that's
not
right.
White for all that much longer, one way or the other.
2009, I'm going to be borough president, and then right after that, 8 years in the borough presidency or four, then I'm going to be Mayor Barron. And wait till you see the changes that come with that.
Never. Charles Barron, city councilman from Brooklyn, my home borough. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You too, brother. And
bye-bye.
This is a Building Bridges, your community and labor report special. And there's so much at stake now. What happens with the transport workers happens with all of us.
Rumblings in the city, fear across the border, crying in the country, fire across the water.
Now, I think the time is now. In some faraway places that you hardly even heard of, there's people doing things that you cannot believe. They're seeing something that they don't want no part of. We're opened up the gates and now they're trying to leave. Where's the law and order? Dying for your country. Cattle to the slaughter.
Now, I think the time is now. India, Ireland, Chile, Korea, Germany, Russia, and there's sure to be more. We're fighting the leaders who drove us with progress, who sold us the war to end the war.
This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report special with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg. And with us now is Eddie Ott. Eddie Ott is with the Central Labor Council. Oh. Eddie Ott, tell us about the position of the Central Labor Council and the issues that you think are so critical for our listeners to know about why they must support our sisters, our brothers, in Local 100 of the Transport Workers Union.
Well, I mean, on a very basic level, this is a union that, since the middle of the last century, has set the standard for blue-collar workers in this city and have taken what we used to call bad jobs and turned them into good, solid, middle-class jobs that have allowed workers who start out at the bottom ladders of the economic rung, the bottom rung of the economic ladder, and end up buying homes, sending their children to schools that they didn't have access before in their families, and allowing blue-collar workers to enter the middle class. And this union has been one of the strongest and most important in this city in creating those kind of ladders. So just on those terms, in a kind of a historic perspective, this is a very important group of workers in the city and to the city's economy, and they have set a certain standard. And every working person in this city who understands that understands what's at stake in this situation. They are being asked to sell out the next generation of unionized workers and workers in the city in order for them to maintain a modicum of their status that they've gained over half a century. And right now, they're refusing to do that. And the Central Labor Council is trying very hard to muster support from everybody in the city, from all quarters, to support these workers. The governor of this state has decided that he wants to set them back. And that's unacceptable.
Eddie, the MTA has offered what I like to call a token wage increase and givebacks from people who have not yet been hired for the next from the next generation. What you were talking about, the governor, is that who is behind this intransigence from the MTA? Is that what's going on here?
Well, look, the governor is responsible. The MTA is a creation of the state. The governor appoints the leadership of the MTA. So, like it or not, they are his representatives. Frankly, I think they like it. But this is a governor that has to face up to the fact that these workers have earned everything that they get. They have helped this state through bad times. And transit workers, when the MTA is in trouble and they're short of money, they've been asked to sacrifice. And now they're sitting here with more, and I'm telling you, substantially more than $1 billion surplus, and they're being asked to sacrifice again. And it's unfair. You know, if they can't share in the surplus, they shouldn't have been asked to sacrifice during the bad times.
But we are
this governor is absolutely intransigent at this point.
Well, we are told, though, that, my goodness, what's a poor MTA to do? Perhaps in 2008 they'll have another deficit, so they have to squirrel money away again on the backs of the workers for a possible deficit. So aren't we being a little flippant and cavalier about our advocacy?
Well, actually, to tell you the truth, I think the people that are being flippant here is the MTA, because the truth of the matter is they don't want to own up to the fact that they can't manage through bad times and they can't manage through good times. And if they can't maintain the conditions that have allowed this system to generate a surplus, that is their responsibility, and they have to own up to that. And maybe we need new management. What I really think is going on here is you have a governor of this state who is trying to prove that he is a fiscal conservative on the backs of these workers, and it's totally unfair.
Eddie, the Central Labor Council has really done quite a bit in terms of support for the MTA workers. Why don't you talk about what's being done and what will be done?
Well, look, the most important thing in the short term is to try to get the word out and to generate actual physical support for the workers as they face this situation. You know, the laws in this state say that if the MTA employees strike, they in fact face onerous fines and penalties that go to individual workers and to the union itself. So one of the things that we're asking working people in the city to do is to, we're going to create a solidarity fund, and we're asking everybody in this city, workers and anybody of goodwill, to help put money into that fund so that the union and the workers will have some protections as they go forward. Now, the particularities of that have not yet been worked out, but that's one thing we're trying to do. The other thing we're trying to do, and this is very, very important, and I know the listeners of this station are huge participants in activities in the city. At 4 o'clock on Monday, there's going to be a demonstration with all the working people of this city in support of the Transit Worker Union and its members at the governor's office at 633 3rd Avenue, which is 40th Street and 3rd Avenue. And we want to show that these workers are not alone. The truth of the matter is, they are asking these guys to sacrifice the pensions of the next generation of workers, the health care benefits of the next generation of workers, so that they can get a rather inadequate raise, a raise that won't even keep up with inflation. And if they do it to them, hospital workers, security workers, building service workers, everybody in this city, civil service workers, will all face the same conditions immediately. The nonprofit institutions of this city are waiting to see how this fight turns out so that they can get the same thing. And if the governor can have the pensions for the next generation, what we're basically saying is that our children will face terrible conditions as they enter the workforce. And what the transport worker members are saying is that they are unwilling to take a giant step backwards for other people so that they can benefit. And they should understand that these workers at great risk and at great sacrifice are really carrying the banner of what organized labor is about. This is a movement that was founded on a very simple premise, that each generation would do slightly better than the previous generation. And what we're being faced with here, both in the private sector and corporate America, and in this state by this MTA, is that they are saying they want to throw that tradition out the window. And that is unacceptable. And these workers are saying right now that they cannot do that. They are unwilling to do it.
Well, Eddie Ott from the Central Labor Council, the New York City Central Labor Council. Eddie Ott, we thank you very much for
being with us. I want to say one thing. It's time for the workers to get tough.
Absolutely.
Overtime.
Overtime. Overtime. Gee, you're being very witty. And that was Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. This is A Building Bridges, your community and labor report special. Well, we're going to listen to the Ken and Adam Lee song, a little bit of the work song now. Well, that is Cannonball Adderley. That is the work song. Sammy Davis Jr. doesn't come in yet. But we're going to play it again later, and we're going to pick up on that. And we have a very tired brother on the phone, but he was gracious enough to be with us, and it's General Counsel for Local 100 of the Transport Workers Union, Arthur Schwartz. Thank you so much for joining us, despite the baby crying in the background. See, no sacrifice is too much for the people we bring on to speak to you. Arthur, why don't we begin with the issues for the men and women who are on the cusp of a needless strike that is being forced by the calcification of the MTA and probably somewhere the hand of Pataki and Bloomberg. But what are the issues?
The issues are coming down to two, really. The first has to do with an attempt by the MTA to have all new hirees lose the opportunity to participate in a pension plan that presently exists that lets employees retire at age 55 if they have 25 years of service, and force that age up to 62 with 30 years of service, and that means retire with half pay. And the second is they want new employees to contribute 1% of their pay to their health insurance coverage, which is something that many people in the private sector do, right? But in the public sector, part of the trade-off for shitty salaries is that they get free health coverage. In the city of New York, teachers, cops, firefighters, transit workers don't pay other city employees. They don't pay for their basic health insurance coverage. They usually have options to buy better coverage than the basic plan, which they might pay for, but they can get health insurance without making a contribution towards it. And, of course, it's always been factored into their, you know, into the wages that they're paid. But it's sort of one of those, always been seen by city employees and transit workers as one of those fundamental rights that they have as a employee is to get free health coverage. So this is the first step of trying to take that away. So, you know, it's pension and health. And it's two areas that are, you know, they're reflecting general problems that exist, you know, in our country with spiraling health care costs and spiraling pension costs, especially with pension plans usually being invested in the stock market and the stock market not doing well. And all of a sudden employers are having to figure out how to pay for pensions and, you know, with current revenues. So this is sort of the transit workers are being singled out, I think, as the first union, first group of workers to be attacked to have this change, to have a worse pension and to pay for their health insurance, sort of a double-barreled attack. And we think that what's going on is not just an effort by the MTA to rein in their costs, but it's also sort of the first salvo in an attack on public employees in New York City, in New York State in general, in both of those areas.
Arthur, people talk to me and they say, why should we support the transit workers? We're not making as much as they are. Why should we support them? And I usually say something to the effect of, this is the beginning, or this is part of the process of the unraveling of the social compact. This is the unraveling of the working class. If they lose, you lose. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, and you know, I don't even know this. We don't make as much, or they don't. We don't make as much as they do. Transit workers don't make a hell of a lot of money. I mean, starting pay, you know, a cleaner starts at about $12 an hour, and maybe some of the more skilled trades started at $16 an hour. They go up to $24, $25 an hour. That translates out to top pay of, you know, $50,000, $55,000 a year. I don't think that makes you rich. You have to take home pay, you know, in New York City, it isn't going to pay for very much. So these aren't like a bunch of wealthy people. I mean, some bus drivers make more than that, but they do it because they work 6 days a week, 10 to 12 hours a day, and never see their families. So, you know, in some ways, they sort of symbolize the best of unionized, you know, industrially unionized workers, and the attack, and they have, you know, decent pensions and decent health care and halfway decent salaries because, you know, they've been organized well going back, you know, to 70 years now. And if things start eroding for them, things get worse for everybody else. Somebody said to me yesterday that, you know, if you beat the transport workers union on issues like this, where you're going to you know, make it 7 years harder for, make people work 7 years longer before they can retire and lessen the retirement benefit, and if you're going to increase their health care costs, then you're going to beat every union in the state. And there's a million and a half unionized people just in New York City alone.
Help us understand also why Roger Toussaint, who's the president, of course, of Local 100 of the TWU, Transport Workers Union, is taking the stance that he is at this juncture.
Roger feels extremely responsible for his own members. He's not. He could take a expedient position and say, "Well, no current employee is going to be affected by this, so nobody will vote against this contract because it doesn't change their retirement date and it doesn't change their health benefit costs." He sees that it becomes a step in the direction of attacking the at least In New York, you can't lessen someone's pension benefits. It's actually protected by the Constitution in the state of New York. It's a constitutional right to your pension. But it could be a first step in the direction of attacking people's health care. But the second thing is he's also got enough vision to see that in 10 years you wind up having a divided workforce. And you have some people who, you know, can't retire till they're 62, and some people who can retire when they're 55. Some people paying a lot towards their health insurance, and some people paying less. And it's a you wind up having this, you know, two-tiered union with people having different interests, and you begin to have factionalism and fighting, and it's not going to be healthy for the union in the long run. So he's fighting it. He's fighting it with an eye towards, as he says, avoid. He doesn't want to sell the unborn. And there's been all too much of a trend in the last couple of years of the newborn being sold. It sort of started with DC-37. About 2 years ago, they signed a contract where they lowered the starting pay for new employees in order to finance a wage increase for existing employees. And then because of that pattern, when the police went to arbitration, the arbitrator said, well, yeah, we're going to follow this idea. We're going to lower the starting salaries of cops to about $25,000 a year so we can increase the pay of the existing cops. And, you know, it's a growing trend that's really bad for the labor movement, and I think Rogers, you know, sees it as a place to draw the line.
I wonder if the audience out there realizes the significance of what you're saying in terms of what the labor movement could be doing if they accept this. What they're basically saying is contractually the next generation will get less.
Yeah. Now, you know, there have been other periods where the union movement has had, you may have heard the term, two-tier wage scales. And they haven't done that for a while. There were periods like in the early 90s, the last time there was a sort of a recessionary period in the U.S. where unions agreed to, including the Transport Workers Union, by the way, under Sonny Hall, agreed to lower starting rates, although usually people caught up after a number of years to the top rate. And, you know, I think the next people will never catch up. You know, you're basically saying, here's a unionized job, and you're going to start it, you know, 10% less or 20% less than the prior generation, which means despite the fact that the price of everything continues to go up, wages of unionized jobs are going to go down, and that means that wages of non-unionized jobs are also going to go down, and you're really hurting not just public sector workers, but you're sort of hurting working people all around, because if the city can do it, then private sector employers can do it, and they'll point to the city, and it begins to create a new way for, you know, the city doesn't make a profit, but, you know, it's symptomatic of what private sector employers will try to get away with. If the city can get away with it, everybody else will try to get away with it.
And this is a Building Bridges, your community and labor report special. We're taking a look at Local 100, the Transport Workers Union, the real issues behind this bargaining effort, this negotiation, which we demand lead to a decent contract. Now, Arthur, I don't know that you saw me, but as I was carrying a number of portfolios fleeting by me, so to speak, trailed by a cabal of media, was yourself in Brooklyn Supreme, where you were fighting against the effort to impose an injunction and the imposition of the Taylor Law. I want you to put on your legal hat for Transport Workers Union Local 100 and tell us about the significance of the activities these last days in court and what it portends for the union. And indeed, good gracious, I'm still waiting for that kind of big, glorious strike where the workers say, the hell with the Taylor Law. I still remember Mike Quill being dragged off to prison, and he
right.
said, drop dead to the man in the black robes.
Right, right. Or that was under a prior law. But,
Condon-Wadlin,
the
yeah.
Condon-Wadlin Act. We were in court both to try to delay the issuance of an injunction under the Taylor Law and to make sure that if it was issued, that it was as narrow as possible. Because we sort of had an example. Back in 1999, a couple of days before the contract was up, Giuliani, well, this is a separate matter. The Transit Authority went into court and got an injunction that prohibited transit workers from not only striking, but from discussing a strike, from taking any action which might tend to encourage somebody to strike, which, you know, prohibited encouragement of a strike, support of a strike, words that go a lot towards speech. And we've sort of engaged in an effort over the 2002 round and now this round, where we have argued to the judge that the discussion of striking, the vote to strike, the threat to strike, is not illegal, and that it is part of free speech and part of the discourse that should go on and is allowed to go on despite the prohibition on striking. And it should be allowed to be part of the, you know, the give and take of contract negotiations. And we actually succeeded, I think, in getting the judge to allow that. He issued an injunction. The injunction, however, said it only barred striking and instigating and inciting a strike. Inciting, even that word bothers us a little bit, but it got rid of the encouraging and supporting and all that language. And he wrote a decision where he said voting to strike is protected by the First Amendment, where he said threatening to strike is protected by the First Amendment. And these were wonderful. This was a wonderful decision. A very interesting judge in Brooklyn, Theodore Jones, who's a former criminal defense attorney, who I think really tried hard to issue an injunction that let everything happen except the actual strike. I mean, you don't really want an injunction because then you're not just dealing with the law, but you're being in contempt of an order. But so we preserved that, and that's why people were allowed on Monday, a Tuesday, which day were they rallying outside? I've lost track of the dates. On Monday,
understandable.
I think there were a couple thousand people out on 42nd Street, and they were able to stand there and yell, strike, 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 and the deadline is a deadline, and no contract, no work, and all those chants, and didn't violate the injunction. And even as late as yesterday, there were about 1,000 people out in front of the hotel, and they were doing the same thing. And nobody ran to court and said, judge, they're violating the injunction, they're threatening to strike. So that's good. That's good. It lets you preserve your ability to threaten up, you know, and it doesn't bar anything really other than the actual act of striking. So that was really part of, you know, what our major effort was in court over the last week. We've also fought really hard. The city, back in 99, Giuliani got some judge to issue a temporary restraining order that not only barred encouraging and supporting and taking any action that might tend to encourage or support a strike. He got the judge to put in there that in a temporary restraining order that he signed in his house at 6 o'clock in the morning without the union being present or any of the defendants. He put in there that, and if you did it, you're going to be liable for $25,000 each instance, $50,000 the second instance, $100,000 the third instance. The city had filed that same lawsuit in 2002 and never acted on, never really presented it to a judge, and then this year they filed it again, and we had warned the judge before they filed it that they were going to file it and move to dismiss it before they even had alerted the judge to its attempt. They had alerted the media to its existence, which, of course, they ate up. But we alerted the judge, and he set up a conference, and they came in and said on Friday, on Thursday, judge, we're not seeking an injunction to get these kind of things, because the judge wouldn't have done it. So anyway, our effort has been to try to allow that the ability to threaten and promote and support striking to go as far as possible into the process. Now the next step would be if the union actually decides on Monday night to go ahead and strike on Tuesday, which is the present scenario.
Just quickly, in the moments that we have left for this, summarize for us what the transport workers union are demanding.
In some ways it's come down to what they're resisting, but they're demanding that the pensions of new employees be the same as the pensions of existing employees. They're demanding that people continue to get free health care. And they're demanding a reasonable wage increase that basically keeps them even with inflation. And they've asked for some improvements in their health coverage. For example, right now their health care pays doctors the 1988 reimbursement rate. You know, it's a schedule that GHI has. And so there are a lot of doctors that won't take the insurance, and then you wind up going out of network, which is more expensive. There's not a lot more, the union, we've reached agreement on a number of other areas that are sort of not an issue, on improvements and ways to try to reduce the number of disciplinary actions, on better appeals processes in different situations, on better apprenticeship programming. There were areas that we spent a lot of time and hammered out a lot of agreements on. So it's really coming down to the wages, the pension, and the health. And the TWU is, fighting to keep that free health care and keep that good pension and get a decent wage increase.
Thank you very much for joining us. I hope you get a little bit of rest. Certainly, we are all with you, and this station is a vehicle whenever you need it to communicate with the riders, with the public, with other workers. Arthur Schwartz, thank you very much for joining us. And we have been speaking with General Counsel.
Just Counsel.
A much more humble title. Counsel for Transport Workers Union Local 100, Arthur Schwartz.
Thank you. You do such a wonderful service to working people in New York City with your show.
Thank you, brother. We want to bring on Stanley Aronowitz, author, labor educator, to talk about the Taylor Law, to again alert us to and involve us in what is happening with our workers in the Transport Workers Union. Stanley Aronowitz, why must we support the transit workers? What is really going on? What's the analysis?
The analysis is that the Metropolitan Transit Authority, which is one of the most arrogant city agencies and state agencies that you can imagine, is trying to get the same kind of concessions that the city administration got from most of the rest of the unions. In this case, they have a couple of very important demands. One of them is that they want a two-tier health system, a two-tier pension system. They want to make the workers pay 2% who are coming in new for their health care. And they're offering relatively paltry wage increases, but there is another issue, and this is one that I don't know whether they've resolved. 16,000 cases annually of disciplinary action against workers, and the union has demanded a much more liberal, that is, not anti-worker, disciplinary policy. But from the pressure on the city and the state, the pressure on the transit authority, but it's really the city and the state, is that this is Christmas season, and they're desperately worried that the most lucrative and one of the most important parts of the New York City economy will be desperately hurt, and that is the tourist industry. And they're worried that if there's a strike, that there'll be cancellations in hotels, restaurants will be empty, or at least much more empty than they would be, and that billions of dollars will be lost to business. You know, they use the word lost to New York, but I'm not entirely sure that the tourist industry is a place where New Yorkers can do better than earn very low wages. They're under pressure from that industry to settle this strike. The union leadership, on the other hand, is under the pressure from their rank and file. See, I think Roger Toussaint, who is the president of the TWU Local 100, is a very moderate labor leader. He knows how to talk the talk, though. He talks the language of militancy because he has a rank and file movement and a rank and file, which is extremely angry. They're not only angry about money, they're angry about their treatment. The treatment of transit workers is as if they are criminals. And the presumption is you're guilty because you're working on the job, and if you make any mistakes, you can be fired, you can lose one day, you can lose 2 days, you can lose a week of pay. So that's a big issue. But you see, every other union has given up some kind of two-tier system. The cops gave up two-tier. Oh, they've given up. They've settled for relatively low wages, except for the United Federation of Teachers, but they gave up time. So what the Transit Authority is facing is a membership of the union that has said, we're not giving up this stuff. This is not what we're here for. And if any union could pull it off, they will. The lurking in the background is the other big issue, which is that the Taylor Law prohibits public employees from striking. And it doesn't matter whether you're city or state employees. And that's a law which essentially reduces workers to powerlessness, because if they give up, if they strike, in this case, they're $1 million a day to the union, $2 million a second day, et cetera. And for the membership, it's $25,000 a day. And so it's really what John L. Lewis described in the Taft-Hartley Act, it's a slave labor law. And I'll tell you what I think. I think if they don't get what they need, this is a wonderful time to try to break that law. And I have been using, in many places where I've talked about this, the following formulation. Martin Luther King said that when they was asked, well, you're breaking the law in the South when you sit in on lunch counters or you sit down on the streets or something like that. And he said, we have no obligation to obey an immoral law. And I believe the Taylor Act is an immoral law, And I think if any union is going to be able to break that law, and if not get away with it, at least show an example to the rest of the labor movement and to the people of New York City that they will not simply crouch, they will not bow, it is the Transport Workers Union.
Stanley, aside from solidarity with the transit workers, with the Transport Workers Union Local 100, to what extent is it is in the interest of other civil service workers, of other workers in the city, of other workers in the state, to support this union at this point?
Well, my view is that this is in everybody's interest, because if they can, A, break the two tiers and the other concessions that are being asked for by the MTA, and B, they can break the Taylor Law, or show that the Taylor Law is not going to cow people, make them bend, every other union can gain some kind of courage. Workers in the city, I mean, we have 3.5 million employees in this New York City. Not all of them are public employees, and many of them are in the private sector. But we have been living for a very long time, and I would date this not to Giuliani, I would date this to Ed Koch. We've been living in an environment of fear, and this has not been helped by September 11, 2001, and people have become much, much more afraid. They're still angry, but they're afraid, and this is a union that is showing the way to fighting against the worst and the most blatant of anti-worker management actions. So it's in everybody's interest to support this union. When Brian McLaughlin, and who's the president of the Central Labor Council, called for a dollar for each member of the Central Labor Council, you're looking at $800,000, which could pay the fines, number one. Number two, it could provide some money for strike relief. That was a very impressive act, and I'm sorry to say it didn't get the kind of publicity that it needed. But if people all over the city, especially in the unions, went around to the shops and the offices and began to ask people for that dollar and began to make a campaign to support the transit workers both materially as well as come out to demonstrations, the Professional Staff Congress, of which I'm a member of the Executive Council, we have been out there. We have been out there both for the NYU strikers, but we've been out for the TWU as well. If the unions begin to show up, then what we begin to get is a sense that maybe, and of course I'm speaking from a very futuristic perspective, we could have a general strike.
Yes, say it loud, say it clear.
We could have a general strike of municipal employees and private sector employees, because this is not the United States. This is not a place, for example, where there's only 7% of private sector employees in unions. This is not a place where the unions, if they actually decided to act as a united labor movement, could not envision victory. And there have been cases in the United States, Seattle, Toledo, Minneapolis, San Francisco in the past, where people went out on general strikes. And I don't think this is impossible. I think people are getting angrier because they've been down so long, they have no place to go but up. And I think this is one of the occasions.
Quickly take us back to 1966, Michael Quill.
In 1966, Michael Quill, who had a checkered career, in my opinion, as the president of the TWU, he was a rabid anti-communist towards the end of his life, suddenly got religion again. I mean the old-time labor religion, and he called a strike of the transit workers. They immediately got a judge to issue an injunction. He was under tremendous pressure that if he violated the injunction, he would be in contempt, and the Lindsay administration had no problem putting him in jail, and he went to jail, defied the injunction, and defied the law that said he didn't have the right to strike, and won the strike. Unfortunately, very shortly thereafter, Michael Quill died. But we could go back, even in 1980, when there was an 11-day strike with a much less militant leadership, they didn't do badly. Ed Koch made a lot of his walking across the bridge with people who were pedestrians, where they used to be subway riders or bus riders. But in fact, the settlement was a pretty good settlement. I don't think outside of direct action, outside of the right and the ability to strike, that unions are basically worth much. Because if you can't withhold your labor, as the Transport Workers Union had done in those two occasions, you really don't have the power.
We're going to have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Stanley Aronowitz, a labor expert extraordinaire, brilliant author, lays it out directly, simply, importantly. We thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And this has been a Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report special, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
I don't care about the government. I think Rockefeller owns the president. Just a shugging for the millionaires. Just one way we're gonna get our share.
That's right.
We got our hands on the wheel, now let's drive it. We got our ass in the saddle.